Well, this morning we complete chapter 9 of Matthew, and we're going to pick it up in verse 18. Matthew chapter 9, verse 18. And it says, as he was speaking these words to them, one of the officers came and bowed down to him and said, at this very moment my daughter is dying. Please come and lay your hand on her, and she will live. Yeshua arose and followed him. Now, this officer, by the way, is a synagogue officer. Synagogues have presidents, and they have chazans, kind of oversee the running of the synagogue service and just kind of make sure things are running smoothly. This would be Rob Horger at Beth Tikkun. All right? If you want to put a face to this story, this would be Rob. So Yeshua arose and followed him, he and his disciples. But then a woman with a flow of blood for 12 years approached from behind him and touched the corner of his garment. For she said in her heart, if only I touch his garment, I will be saved. Yeshua turned and saw her and said, be strong, my daughter. Your faith has saved you. The woman was saved from that time on. Yeshua came to the house of the officer and saw the pipers with flutes and the groaning people. And he said, go away from here, for the child is not dead. She's only sleeping. And they mocked him. When they cleared the people from there, he came into the house and took hold of her hand. And the girl arose. The news about this spread throughout that whole land. A very well-known story. And it's recorded here in Matthew. It's also recorded in Mark and also in Luke. And in all three accounts, it has the officer coming to Yeshua. My 12-year-old daughter is dying. Please come to my home and heal her. And while he's on the way, an older woman comes who has a hemorrhage. She's has an issue of blood. And she's had it for 12 years as well. And she comes up behind him and she says, if I can only grasp the corner of his garment, and Yeshua would have had tzitzits on the corner of his garment, if only I could just grasp that, I'll be made well. She grasped the corner of his garment. She was healed. Yeshua felt power go out of him. And he turns around, there she is, and she feels a little guilty because this a woman who has an issue of blood, she's not really supposed to be around crowds of people, but she was. She was so desperate for help. And he blesses her and says, your faith has made you well. And she was well from that day on. Well, then he gets a message from the officer's home. Don't bother the teacher anymore. Your daughter has died. But Yeshua says, just believe. Just believe. Don't be afraid. Everything will be well. He comes into the house, drives everyone else out, goes in with Peter, James, and John and the parents, takes her by the hand, tells her to rise up. Up she gets. And the story always follows this pattern. He's going to heal the little girl. The older woman comes behind and touches the corner of his garment, gets healed. The little girl dies. He goes on to the home and brings a resurrection. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all record it in that way. Now, Matthew has the shortest account of this. It's only about 9 verses long. Matthew has the longest account. It's almost as long as Matthew and Luke's account put together, which is unusual. Mark is the shortest gospel. It's the one that's the most terse and just right to the point. It's action-packed. There's not a lot of explanation, but when it comes to this, Mark has about 22 verses. And so between the three accounts, we can get a complete picture put together. But there's one piece of information that Matthew supplies that the other two don't. And it's right there in the opening of verse 18. As he was saying these words to them, this all happened. Matthew's the only one that tells us what was the context for these events. So we have to ask the question, what are these words that he was speaking? So let's go up a little higher. And go to verse 16. Now, he's talked before this about the bridegroom and the wedding canopy and the attendant of the bride. But let's pick it up in verse 16. No one puts a new patch on a worn-out garment, because the piece would become detached from the garment and the tear would be made worse. People do not put new wine into used wineskins, or else the wineskins would be split open. The wine would be poured out, and the wineskins would be ruined. Rather, people put new wine into new wineskins, so both will be preserved together. So he's talking about old cloth, new cloth, old wineskins, new wine. And while he was saying these words, there's a call for an old woman and a new woman. An old woman and a young lady. While he's saying these words, what Matthew's telling us is that these events are connected directly to his teaching about cloth, old and new, and about old and new wine and wineskins. In other words, what is being allegorized by the cloth and the wine and wineskins is being realized in the lives of these two females, one old and one young. Are we with it together so far? And I had never seen that before. I sat down last Sunday or Monday and I thought, okay, what are we going to talk about next week? And I looked at this as he's speaking these words. What words? I go up and he's talking about old and new, and all of a sudden we have old and new again. So somehow, the cloth, new and old, and the new wine, old wine skins, have to do with this young girl and this older woman. The girl's 12 years old, and the woman has been suffering with the hemorrhage for 12 years. That's not coincidence. And then I started noticing something else. With this woman, she's a leaky wineskin. Wine's always a picture of blood. She had a hemorrhage of blood for 12 years. But how was she healed? By touching a piece of cloth, touching a garment. So here we see the wine pictured, or blood pictured by wine, and we see garments once again connected together in her story. So let's try to walk this through and figure out what's really going on. Let's talk about the little girl first, because she is what starts the story. Her father's coming to call Yeshua to come bring healing, and at the end of the story, he gets there and then actually raises her from the dead. But sandwiched in the middle of that, which I think is the key to the whole story, is the story of this older woman who's hemorrhaging. I want you to picture this family. And in Mark's gospel, he tells us that this girl is the man's only child. She's 12 years old. Now, in Judaism, in first century Israel, you wanted to have children. Children were proof of God's blessing. You wanted a son, too, who could carry on the name and who could help take care and do the work and take care of you when you're older. But this was his only child. He had this daughter, 12 years old. Maybe they had difficulty conceiving. We don't know what happened after her birth, but they had no more children. He has this one daughter. So picture it. Here is a family, a husband and a wife, and they've got this gap in their lives. They want a child. And there are many accounts in the scriptures of a couple who had difficulty conceiving. Lord, send us a child. We want a child. And so God puts this new piece of cloth in the hole of the older cloth. Now we're complete. But with this little girl, her spirit began to leave her, this gospel say. She began to die and to pull away as her body is dying. And with the tear, the ripping it caused in the heart of the father, and I'm certain the mother as well, is something that only someone who may have lost a child could understand. And Yeshua says, no one puts a new patch on a worn garment. And he says, people do not put new wine in old wineskins. But if there's a way to sum up the entire teaching in this passage, I would say it's restoration. And I don't think God's concerned with patching up old wineskins and patching up old garments, but he's very concerned with restoring people, living wineskins and living garments. And the rest of this chapter is about tikkun, restoration and repair. And what he doesn't do with wineskins, he does with people. What he does not do with garments, he does with people. And what does he do? As this new life in this family is ripping and tearing away and finally dies, what does Yeshua do? Restores her to life. Puts her back into the arms of her parents. Says, feed her. And she's up and walking around. And here's this leaky wineskin. I know that sounds kind of crass, but this woman has had this hemorrhage for 12 years, which means she can't have children because she cannot have relations with her husband. Because as long as she is in this state of menstruation, she cannot, according to the Torah, have relations with her husband. She cannot eat of the Passover sacrifice. She cannot go to the temple in Jerusalem. And she is so restricted in so many ways because she's ritually unclean. And I want you to get an idea of what this woman had to go through. It says there that she had a discharge of blood. Now, if you have the Delitzsch Gospels, you will see this phrase. And zavat dam. Zavat means a discharge. And a woman who has a discharge is called a zava. And dam is the word for blood. And if you have the Delitzsch Gospels, you can look over at the right-hand page where the Hebrew is. Go down to verse 20. And you'll see that the third and fourth words are what you see on the screen. Zavat dam. It says, vahine isha. And behold, a woman. Zavat dam. Discharge of blood. Shiteim Esterim, 12 years. Mark gives us some more information. He tells us that she had suffered much under many physicians and had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. Would you like to know what kinds of things she suffered under physicians? This is one of the values of the Talmud. The Talmud gives us an insight into first century life in Israel. And it gives us an extended section where it describes what a woman would go through if she's a zava for an extended period of time and how she could get healed. It says, for healing a zava, and this is from Tractate Shabbos, page 110a, for healing a zava, the potion should consist of all three ingredients mixed with wine, and it will not make her sterile. An alternative remedy is one should bring these, and the three things that are to be brought are, it's mentioned up here earlier, Alexandrian gum, alum, and garden saffron, just if you're taking notes, okay. And these three are to be mixed with Persian onions. You boil them in wine, give the drink to the zava, and say to her, Kum mitzvecha. Now this is very important. Kum mitzvecha. The word kum right here means to arise. The mem means from. Zovecha means your discharge. Kum mitzvecha. Now let me go on. Another remedy for a zava is one should sit her at a crossroads and have her hold a cup of wine in her hand. Then someone should sneak up behind her and frighten her and say to her, Kum mitzvecha. Arise from your discharge. If that doesn't work, one should bring a fistful of cumin, a fistful of saffron, and a fistful of fenugreek. One should boil them in wine and give it to the zava to drink. Then one should say to her, Kum mitzvecha, arise from your discharge. If that doesn't work, one should bring 60 clay seals of a barrel. They would seal a barrel with clay seals. You'd soak them in water and soften them, then smear them on her and say to her, Kum mitzvecha. If that doesn't work, one should bring pastina. Now, pastina is a thorn bush. And it's some kind of a sap or something from the thorn bush, I assume. And boil it in wine, smear it on her, and say to her, Kum mitzvecha, arise from your discharge. If that doesn't work, by the way, Dr. Martin, are any of these familiar to you from medical school? No. You haven't heard of these? See, you're going to learn something today as well. You might want to write these down. I'll give you my notes. And if not, one should bring carnauga of a romesa bush. Now, carnauga is a type of herb that grows on this thorn bush. Burn it and take its ashes in linen rags in the summer or in cotton rags in the winter. If that doesn't work, one should dig 7 holes, burn a branch of a young orla vine in each one of them. Then one should have her hold a cup of wine in her hand, stand her up from one hole and sit her over another. Then stand her up from that hole and sit her over another. And each time she stands up, one should say to her, Kumitzaveka. And if that doesn't work, one should bring fine flour, smear it over the lower half of her body and say to her, Kumitzaveka, arise from discharge. And if that doesn't work, you bring an ostrich egg, you burn it, take its ashes and linen rags in the summer, cotton rags in the winter, and it goes on. Amazing, isn't it? What I want to express, the reason I'm going through all of this is because I want this phrase to be burned into your minds. Because this is a very, very, very well-known phrase to the first century Jew in Israel. Kum mitzvecha, arise from your discharge. Now, the woman, though, she's tried all these things, spent all of her money, no better, and she decides, you know, if I can just go up behind Yeshua, touch the corner of his garment, I'll be made well. Now, what in the world would make her think that? And most of you know the answer to this. She is familiar with Malachi 4:2. Malachi 4:2, and then the Hebrew Bible's chapter 3, and I think like the last verse of chapter 3. The verse and chapter numbers are off a little bit between the English and the Hebrew Bible. It says, but for you who fear my name, God speaking, says, the Son of Righteousness shall rise with healing in its wings. Healing in its wings. Well, being a Hebrew speaker, she knew that that word kanaf, for wing, also means corner. It's the same word. And though kanaf is a feminine noun, it can take either a masculine ending with a plural ending, kanafim, or it could take a feminine plural ending, kanafot. But here it's kind of interesting. In Malachi, it doesn't take either one. It's kanaf yah, kanaf yadhe, which are the first two letters of God's name. It's almost as if saying, with healing in the wings of Adonai, or in the corners of Adonai. It's very odd. It's only done that way twice in the whole Bible. And this word is found over 130 times in Scripture, but only twice spelled that way. So, you could read this, the Son of Righteousness shall rise with healing in his corners. She goes up to the corner of his tallit. She touches it, and sure enough, she's healed. That's amazing. By the way, the next part of this, you shall go out leaping like calves from the stall. What do calves speak of? Of youth. Remember, this story is about an old woman and a young girl, about restoration of health and also resurrection of life together. But as we go on a bit further, we have to ask the question, well, what's so special about the corners of a man's garment in first century Israel? Well, anyone who knows the Torah at all knows, or comes to the prayer service, we read this every week and we pray it. Numbers 15, verses 38 and 39, speak to the people of Israel and tell them to make tzitzit. And these little tassels you see are tzitzit. Tzitziot is the plural. That's a tzitzit. Speak to the people of Israel and tell them to make tzitzit on the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and to put a cord of tchelet. And I put tchelet in blue because that's the blue thread that you see on this tzitzit here. Put a tchelet, a cord of tchelet on the tzitzit of each corner, and it shall be a tzitzit for you to look at and remember all the commandments of Adonai, to do them, not to follow after your own heart, and after your own eyes. These are the two things, by the way, folks, that get us in trouble. Following our hearts, follow our eyes. You know, there's one thing that really gripes me about the spirit of this age is the message, follow your heart. Follow your heart. Just follow your heart. And then the movie always ends in a happy ending because they followed their heart. You just try that in real life and it's a disaster. You follow your heart, you're going to mess up. And I always think Hitler followed his heart. Right? And who's the nincompoop who was the, I think it's an appropriate term, for the dictator of North Korea? Yeah, Kim Jong-il. He followed his heart. Stalin followed his heart. Every person who's in prison right now because they're guilty of a crime did it because they followed their heart or their eyes. We are not to follow our hearts. Our hearts, the word tells us, are ill and weak. I know the King James says they're desperately wicked. That is not the case. They're just very ill and they're very weak and unreliable. We are to instead trust in God's heart. And he has revealed his heart, his mind, his thoughts to us through his word. That's what we trust. So, walking in faith means trusting what God says. But not walking in faith means following my emotions, my heart, my eyes, my feelings. And boy, that is always an absolute disaster when we do that. It's destructive to us and all of those around us. So, he said, put these tzitzit on the corners. And garments in the first century basically were like ponchos. They all had four corners. And so they would put these on all four corners of their garments. Over time, garments changed. I don't have a four-corner garment. My pants don't have four corners. My shirt doesn't have four corners. And so what we do is we have a four-corner garment called a tallit to which we can attach the tzitzit. Now, if you do attach them to your belt loops or something, that's fine. I'm not getting legalistic. I'm just saying that it's not the tallit that's so important. The tallit simply provides four corners to which to attach the tzitzit. And I put two on each of my corners, a white one and a blue one, because some people have white, some have blue, and I thought, why not? We'll just do both. It's like making a hamburger. You put everything on it, right? Put everything on. Now, here's a close-up of these, so you can see them a little better. Now, the four tzitzit are each made of four threads that are looped up through a hole, and so they come out looking like eight, which is simply because they're doubled. And the reason some tzitzit are all white is because the word tehelet is a very specific shade of blue. It's the only word for blue found in the scriptures, but there are other words for blue. It's just that this is the only one used in the Bible. It's a very specific shade of blue. And this blue dye was made in a very specific way. And for centuries, the way of making, for making that particular shade of blue, was lost. And so, out of fear of putting the wrong shade of blue on, the Orthodox Jewish people have just worn white tzitzis. But scientists and archaeologists have now rediscovered the way that the original tekelet was made. And it's made from the shell, or from a little gland inside of a type of a clam, oyster, a mollusk, snails, of a snail. It's a little tiny, like the size of a pinhead, this little gland. And they have to take this snail that's found in the Mediterranean, and they have to collect hundreds of these. And they dry them. It's a very complicated process, but it provides you with this beautiful kind of a deep blue color. Now, when they're tied, the four tzitzits, each made of four strings, they're tied with four wraps, as you can see here. You've got a wrap up in here, one there, one there, one there. And you can see it also with the blue. And when these are wrapped, the traditional way to do it is that you wrap it 7 times there, 8 times there, 11 times there, and then 13 times there. Why? Well, 7 plus 8 plus 11 add up to 26. And you can't see 26 on this screen very well, can you? But 26, 7 plus 8 plus 11 equals 26. 26 is the number of God's name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, Adonai. 13 is the number for the word Ahava, love, and also for the word Echad, one. And when we say the Shema, we say Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai, 26, Echad, 13. God is one. And so these numbers are of wraps are put on here to represent the fact that God is one. But they put it in four groups, four corners, four strings, four wraps on each tzitzit. And four is always the number of witness, the number of testimony from heaven to earth. What did God create on the fourth day? He placed the sun, moon, and stars to be signs and moedim, for signs and for seasons, and to bear a testimony and a witness to us on earth. Okay? So four is always the number of witness from heaven to earth. And coincidentally, how many gospels do we have? Four. Three of those gospels are the gospels that kind of give a historical view. We call those three the synoptic. I started to say semantic. I knew that wasn't right. Synoptic gospels. But then John's is the oddball out, the odd man out. John wrote his gospel after the book of Revelation. So he gives us a very, very different kind of book. And just as you have three strings that are white, you've got a fourth one that is blue. If you want to think of these in gospel terms, the three white strings would be like Matthew, Mark, and Luke. The blue one is like John's gospel. Yeah. So I may be reading too much into it, but you know what? We'll find out someday whether if I'm off or not on this. Now, the word tzitzit itself is only found four times in the Bible. Three times in this passage, here, here, and here, referring to strings on the corners of your garment. But the fourth time, like that blue string, is very, very different. And that is over in Ezekiel. Ezekiel 8:3. And I guarantee your translations, unless you have a Jewish Bible, has it wrong. Ezekiel is having this vision of God, and it says, he put out the form of a hand. God put out the form of a hand and took me by a tzitzit of my head. And the Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven and brought me into visions of God to Jerusalem. Tzitzit of my head. Now your translation will say a lock of hair. What's the tzitzit of a head? Well, we're to put tzitzit on a garment to look at so we don't explore after our eyes and after our hearts. Well, I think that fourth blues thread there and the fourth mention of tzitzit in the Bible is like that's that internal one that connects us directly to the Father. In our heads and in our hearts and our minds, we see God's presence. And everything about Ezekiel here is so utterly spiritual that there's a tzitzit in his head. And God just lifts him up to heaven, between heaven and earth. I don't know. It's a very odd image, but I had to share it with you. But that's the four times the word tzitzit is actually used in the scriptures. Why blue? Why blue? Why tichelet? Why is this so important? And when you think about it, it's kind of odd that the tzitzit, it's attached at the top, and then what's attached to at the bottom? Nothing. It just hangs down. Gravity just makes it hang down. But the woman grabbed hold of it, and now it's attached at the top and the bottom. It's attached to Yeshua's garment at the top and attached to her at the bottom. And when that happens, like a circuit being completed, and he felt power go out from him. And he said, "Who touched me?" And his disciples said, "Well, you're in the crowd. Everybody's touching you." He says, "No, somebody touched me in a special way, and I felt power go out." And then finally this woman comes up. And you can imagine mixed emotions. She's thrilled that she's healed, but now she figures she may be in serious trouble for being in a crowd in her state. But he blesses her, and he just wanted to acknowledge her, look to her face to face. And I think sometimes we receive something from the Father. We receive something from God, from Yeshua. And we're not quite sure what happened until he turns around and faces us face to face. And you see his face. And you see the joy there. What you did was right. It was good. And if you were unsure about yourself before, you can be sure now. Go in peace. You're well. That's amazing how our Savior works. But what's the deal with Zizi? Why the blue? Well, Gary and I were talking about this during the week, and it occurred to me that the sky is blue, and the commentators all talk about how the tzitzit is supposed to be the color of the sky. And on the second day of creation, it says that God separated the waters above from the waters below, and that's the only day of creation he did not say it is good. Now, we know everything he did was good, but he just didn't state it for that day. He didn't state. And this is why the second day of the week, Monday, is a lot of times you don't want to say it's good, you know, I think. But he didn't say it was good because things that are the same belong together. And to separate the waters from the waters, that's not normal. This is why I believe in the new heavens and new earth. We see there are no more seas. The waters have gone back up for where they belong. You see, there are no more seas. But the sky is blue. And if you ask people why the oceans are blue, a lot of them say it's because it reflects the sky. And there's a little truth in that. But did you know that water itself is blue? We always think of water as being clear. If you have a small amount of water, you can't see the blue in it. But scientifically, if you can get absolutely purified, clear, distilled water, and you get enough of it, and you put it in a white container, you will see the blue tint. And the larger you can make that container with the more water, the bluer it gets, because you can see, I should say, the more the blue is revealed. But water itself is blue. It is not completely clear. It is blue. So you have blue down here, and you've got blue up there, and here we are in between. And it's almost as if God's saying, I want you to put these on here, because when you put these on, to remind you to follow my word, which came from the heavens and through Moses was given to you on earth, what happens is you begin to tie heaven and earth together. You begin to connect the spiritual and the physical together. The tikkun takes place in you as you take each thing in this world and you submit it to my commandments, which came from heaven, and you make this blue connection. You bring the waters above and waters below together. You bring healing to the world. You bring tikkun. As we read through the Torah, and I always love meditating on this, more of the Torah is given to the description of the tabernacle than any other topic. And in the tabernacle, what you have are two things from two different realms. You have all the materials, the silver, the gold, the precious stones, the wood, the fabrics, the hides, the dyes. You have all these things, and where did they all come from? They all came from Egypt. That's one realm, the world of Egypt. The other thing you have are the instructions, and they come from God. And God tells Moses, you make this tabernacle according to the pattern I showed you in the heavens. And here are the instructions. This is what you do. You take the heavenly instructions, his words, which are utterly spiritual, and then you take these physical materials which came out of Egypt, and you submit them to the instructions, and then what happens, what results, is a dwelling place for God's Shekinah on earth. You get the picture? That's what happens when we obey his commandments, and that is what this is to picture. It's to picture the fact that we are taking God's instructions for our lives, that we're taking our abilities, our time, the physical things we have, and submitting them to the obedience of God's instructions. And we're tying the blue with the blue. We're bringing the heavens and the earth together, the waters above and the waters below. And that might sound like I'm reading a lot into it, but there's some support for this. Because if we go on to Exodus 24, verses 9 and 10, God's having the covenant meal with Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, Aaron's two sons, and the 70 elders of Israel. And they go up, it says, and they saw the God of Israel, and there was under his feet, as it were, a pavement of sapphire stone. What color is sapphire? Blue. like the very heaven for its clearness. And also Ezekiel 1:26. He's having this vision. And above the expanse over their heads, there was the likeness of a throne, an appearance like sapphire blue. What I do know is that the rabbis write about Tekhelet, about blue, and they ponder it and meditate on it. Why blue? Why is that so important? And it seems to be the color of the very foundation under God's feet, the color of his throne. And he invites us to put this on the garments that we wear so that we can remember to connect earth with heaven. So when we eat, when we dress, when we spend our time, arrange our calendar, we're always submitting it to the spiritual. We're submitting it to what God speaks. And the rabbis teach, and I like this idea, and it, you know, you can take it or leave it, but they say God himself wears a tallit with the tzitzit hanging down. And they base that on Psalm 104 too. In fact, if you say the blessing before you put on a tzitzit, or put on your tallit, this is part of the blessing. It's Ot Or Kasama, and I forget, how's it go? If I say the whole thing, I can do it. Shemayim Nekaria. You cover yourself with light as with a garment, stretching out the heavens like a curtain. And that word for curtain there is the same word that's used for the 10 curtains that make the ceiling of the tabernacle. He stretches out the heavens like a curtain. So the tabernacle had the 10 curtains that made the ceiling. You looked up, that's what you saw. It says God also is stretching out the heavens like a curtain. It says he covers himself with light. His tallit is made of light. And they say if God's wearing a tallit, then it must have tzitzits on it. And if he's commanding us to put tzitzit on our garments, it must be because he has them on his. That's their thinking. But I think in many ways, I think of Yeshua as being the tzitzit of the Father. And we are to take hold. Because at one end, he is connected with the Father and with an unbreakable connection. But this is hanging down, inviting us, do you want restoration? You want healing? You want your life back? Take hold. Take hold. You get the picture? What I'm doing, I know that a lot of the thoughts I'm giving you are just the thoughts I have as I meditate on these things. And you're invited to embrace them, reject them. You can do with them whatever you want to do. You're not going to hurt my feelings. But I invite you to also think about these things. God tells us what to do, gives us a little reason why, but then we're to meditate and ponder on these. And I think there's some hints in Scripture, but it's about as far as it goes. But to me, there's something wonderful going on here. There's something amazing going on. And Priscilla, I saw your hand up. If you're visiting, you're welcome to ask questions or share comments.
Isn't it appropriate for women to wear?
There's no reason why a woman can't. But in Judaism, only the men wear the tallit with the tzitzit. There's nothing the Torah says you can't. So here's the predicament. If you want to wear them, go ahead. But I would do it in a way you're not offending anyone. All right? That's always the sensitivity. Yeah, I want to do what God says, but we're also one of his commandments is don't make an offense. Don't stir up things. Don't flaunt your way versus how people are doing it around you. And so I'd say be sensitive in how you do it and not in a way that flaunts it. And when I wear tzitzit, I wear them under my clothes. I don't wear them outside. There's nothing wrong with wearing them visibly. It's just, it's nothing wrong. But there aren't rules. We don't know. There are no rules laid out that you have to do it exactly this way. And so there's an open invitation here, and there's a lot of room for application as well.
One other thing.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
No, one of the cords is just longer than the rest because you're using it to wrap. Mm-hmm, yeah, but there's only four there, and they go through it, so it looks like eight coming down. Yeah, you have to make one longer so you have enough to wrap. Yes, David.
Grant, it's almost like you could say blue is kind of the most say fascinatingly, linguists have discovered that in early languages, when languages are early in their development, they don't have the word blue consistently.
Mm.
And apparently those people who spoke those languages did not see the color blue, even though it was all around them. And they say if you ask a child even today, what color is the sky, they usually don't say blue. They will almost never say blue. They think it's clear, they think it's yellow.
Isn't that interesting?
It confuses them that there's this other color blue. You know, but now we can reproduce it very easily.
Yeah.
Teach our children very quickly that color. But anciently, so it's almost like blue is a hidden color.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's all around us, it's everywhere around us, it's actually hidden from us at our early stages.
That's fascinating. That is really fascinating. Interesting. And, you know, we take color so for granted in this present world, but in ancient times, it's a pretty colorless world. Dyes were not well developed, and the ones they did have were very expensive. Only the extremely wealthy could wear them, could afford them. And so things are kind of just brown, isn't? And they had the green in the leaves, and there wasn't much color in the ancient world. Whereas now, looking at the clothing here, it's colorful, and no matter what you get, it could be a mechanical device, and you get to pick what color you want. And we live in a very colorful world compared to what it was, you know, even 400 or 500 years ago. Yeah. Yes, Jim.
In the record of the young girl,
mm-hmm.
Was dying, and then he was sidetracked by the older lady, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Anyway, in the record, he's approached by those that informed him and said, "Forget coming, she's died."
Yeah.
He says, "Just let believe." Okay, he went and raised her from the dead.
Mm-hmm.
Was it his power, or was there significance in the belief that this?
Oh, well, let's get to that as we go. We're going to get back to the little girl here soon. We'll try to address that. And I'd have to say yes, both. Yes. That's always a cheap way out, is it? See, just for this, yes, yes. Robin, I saw your hand up.
Priscilla's question prompted a thought. Hopefully it'll be interesting to someone else. It's interesting to me. In Proverbs 7, the Lord says that we should bind his commandments on our fingers.
Yes.
Life is the culmination of living Torah. The thing that you see over and over and over is her using her hands.
Yes.
She extends her hands to the poor. She plants a vineyard. She makes clothing. She makes food. And so really, the way God has designed women in this world, I think, is for the commandments to so be bound to her hands and what
yes.
she does that you don't even need a garment.
Right. Yes, that's right.
And I believe that that is the ultimate way a woman can
wear. Yeah. That's brilliant. I wish you could just speak that right in here, but I'm going to try to sum up what you said. It goes back to, Priscilla, in Judaism, you know, men are commanded to wear the tzitzit. Women are excused from it. One of the main reasons is because women are more spiritual to start with, and men aren't. And so we need the reminders more than women do. But Robin's quote from Proverbs 3, correct? Proverbs 7, I'm sorry. Proverbs 7 talks about binding his commandments to our fingers. We know there are 10 commandments and 10 fingers. 5 on one tablet, 5 on the other. The first 5 on the right tablet are the spiritual. The 5 on the left tablet are the physical, like we were talking about before. And so it's a brilliant picture. And wisdom is connected with working with the hands. And the description of the woman of valor, she's working, producing with her hands. She's got the commandments in play all the time, and they're so productive through her life. And, it's an amazing picture, beautiful picture. Thank you for sharing that. I think I saw one other hand up, but then we need to move on. Yes, David, back in the corner.
Biologically speaking, our cones in our eyes, only 10% of them
Ah. Wow. David was just sharing that the cones in our eyes allow us to see color. 90% of them, I'm going to sum up, allow us to see red and green. Only 10% allow us to see blue. Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting stuff. So anyways, maybe we'll stir up some study here. I'll just be wanting to study blue through the week. And I'm sure it'd be a fruitful study. Anyways, since this healing process worked so well for this woman, guess what? Everybody got in on the act. Matthew 14, 35 and 36 says, "And when the men of that place recognized him, they sent around to all that region and brought to him all who were sick and implored him that they might only touch," there it is, "the corner of his garment, and as many as touched it were made well." So this woman started something, didn't she? But I think there's a future fulfillment of this, because Zechariah 8:23 talks about the kingdom to come. And thus says Adonai of hosts, "In those days, 10 men from the nations, 10 Gentiles, of every tongue shall take hold of the corner of a Jew, saying, 'Let us go with you, for we have heard that God is with you.'" Healing is always connected somehow, restoration and healing, with the corners and with what is placed there, this reminder, not to follow our eyes and hearts, but to follow God's word. And flowed out as healing to the people here in the Gospels. And the future will flow out as healing to the nations. It's going to be an amazing time. Now, in Mark's Gospel, he gives some more information, as I mentioned earlier, than the others. And he actually gives us a quote in Aramaic of what Yeshua spoke. In Mark 5:41, Yeshua, he goes into the house of the dead girl. Taking her by the hand, he said to her, "Talyeta kumi." Now, where have you seen that word, kum? Arise. Remember how we read it? And this had been a familiar word to them, and part of the remedy for the Zava. But he says, "Talyeta kumi." Now, that's the Aramaic pronunciation. In Hebrew, it would have been "Talita kum," which means "little girl," and the "I say to you" is not there in the Aramaic. "Little girl, arise." That's what it looks like, and you can see that in the daily Gospels in Mark 5:41. If you go there, "Talita kumi." Now, a lot of you gentlemen have one of these. In fact, I have one up here. You wear a talit, and it's carried in a talit bag with the words "talit" there in Hebrew. Which just so happened, if you look at it, tet, lamed, yud, tav. Tet, lamed, yud, tav. Talita is a little girl, but talit is what I have hanging right here. Again, you see this word talit, a garment. And remember, he's talking about new cloth, old garments. The woman's healed by touching a garment. And then you have the story about the wine and the wineskins and leaking out. And here's a woman who has a hemorrhage for 12 years. And over and over and over, she heard the words, mitzvecha, you know, arise. And here you see them coming together with this little girl. This isn't coincidence. I don't see all the connections. I don't even begin to claim to. But something wonderful and amazing and under the surface is going on. But what I see as we continue on through the chapter, what I see is this. God is speaking through Yeshua. And he's starting with the physical. It begins to work in to address the spiritual in more deep and deep and deeper ways. So he starts talking about wine skins and wine. And old cloth, new cloth. But then there's these two women. Now this is more real. With real physical problems. A hemorrhage for 12 years. A 12-year-old girl now who is dead. But what does he do? He restores them both on the same day. The same day that the little girl was born, this woman developed a hemorrhage. 12 years later, the little girl dies but is resurrected and the woman is healed. God is working restoration. And in these words, I see the stories coming back again. Together. Talit. Kum, arise. But then he goes on further. Let's go a little bit more. You know, there's a, I have to share this verse, Ephesians 5:27. You ever wonder about this? It talks about the purification of a bride. So you might present the kahal. Yours might say church, redeemed community, but the Hebrew word would be kahal to himself in splendor without spot or wrinkles. A wrinkle refers to a garment. A spot refers to something spilled on that garment, like wine. And God is preparing a bride that hasn't done any spots, like the old woman. There are no wrinkles, like the garment. These two themes are being woven together in a number of places, aren't they? But it goes on. He works in a deeper way. As we go on through the chapter now, go back to Matthew chapter 9. I know you forgot what we're even studying, but Matthew chapter 9. And we're going to pick it up in verse 27. Yeshua passed on from there, and two blind men followed him. Now this time, instead of two females, we have two men. Two blind men following him. And they were shouting, saying, "Be gracious to us, Son of David." This is the first time Yeshua is called this by someone else. And Son of David is equivalent to Messiah. It was understood. Someone who's called the Son of David, that's a reference to the Messiah. And when he came to the house, the blind men approached him, and Yeshua said to them, "Do you believe that it is in my hand to do this?" They said, "Yes, our master." He touched their eyes and said, "May it be to you according to your faith." Their eyes were opened. And Yeshua warned them, and he said, "Make sure that it is not made known to anyone." But when they left, they proclaimed the news throughout that whole land. What's one of the purposes of tzitzit? So you don't wander and stray after your eyes. And here are two blind men. And sometimes I think, if not all the time, most of the time, it's by following our eyes that we become like the old woman, one who just, our life is leaking out of us. Because we follow our eyes, we sin. The wages of sin is death, like the little girl dies. So now he's walking a little bit deeper, saying, "No, what's the cause of the issues? Blindness, spiritual blindness. I wish I knew what the remedy was for spiritual blindness. I don't know what it is. Because there's plenty of spiritual light around. But people can't see it. It's not a problem with the light. It's a problem with the eyes. But I think there has to be a hunger to see. The first step, I think, in being healed of spiritual blindness is realizing that there are people who do have spiritual sight. How would blind men ever know that they're blind if they were not aware that other people could actually see? The awareness that people can see makes me aware that I don't. But some people in their pride, in their ego, cannot acknowledge that they fall short in something. And they will continue to go along and try to bluff others into thinking they can see when they can't. Because it's obvious to a seeing person that a blind person is blind. But if we can humble ourselves and realize others can see, that's something I lack. Touch me. Help me. Open my eyes. Give me this ability to know you in a way that I haven't known you before. And to know things as they really are, as they truly appear. Interesting thing, though. The word for blind in Hebrew is the word ivrim. And you'll find that also in the Daily Gospels. If you go over to the right-hand page, you go down to verse 27, go all the way to the left end of the line, then back up one word, and that's what you'll see, the word ivrim. Ivrim means blind. But it's a homophone. When you say the word ivrim, it can mean blind or it can mean Hebrews. The only difference is the second letter right here. You replace the vav up here with the bet, it becomes Hebrews, but it's pronounced exactly the same, ivrim. And I'm sure that when Yeshua ever talked about the ivrim, the blind, he was also using a play on words to let them know, some of you Hebrews are blind. You see what I'm saying? Oh, hand up. Yes, Steve.
Our society does not teach humility.
You are so right. Other cultures teach humility. We live in a culture where pride and arrogance is elevated. I know as a kid, if I can sidetrack for a second, I know as a kid, when we played sports, you know, I played baseball when I was a kid and different games, and the coaches would always teach us, you know, you go in there and you do your best and you're going to play, but there's another stuff like, we can do it, we're the best. That was unheard of in sports. Unheard of. It wasn't until later, with a certain sports figure started boasting on himself, and it was shocking to people's ears. Who boasts about himself? I'm the best. I'm the fastest. I can beat anybody. I'm the greatest. That was unheard of. But now that's common. That's the norm. And it's a complete shift in our thinking where pride, arrogance, boastfulness is elevated to a character quality, but it isn't. And in past cultures, humility was elevated, as it should be. But anyways, it's a weird day we live in. It is not normal. But what causes spiritual blindness? Let's go further. Verse 32. They went out, and then people brought him a mute man gripped by a demon. He drove out the demon, and the mute man began to speak. And the crowd of people was amazed and said, nothing like this has ever been seen in Israel. There's that word see again. But the Perushim, the Pharisees, said, he drives out demons by the prince of demons. Wrong. What can lie behind blindness? And what's so awful about not being able to talk? That seems like, I can think of some cases where that would have been a great blessing. There's times I wish I could have been mute instead of saying what I said. We have to understand that in the Hebrew mind, if you're mute, you can't pray. Prayer is always done aloud. Now, of course, they know God can hear my thoughts, but to truly pray, you must speak. To read, you must speak. Silent reading was unheard of, and that's a very recent phenomenon just over the last few centuries. I know in school, just read silently, read silently. Do you know that was never heard of before? When you prayed or read, you read aloud. In fact, you would just pronounce the letters. It wasn't until the words came back in your ears that you understood what you were actually reading. And the word in Hebrew for read, kara, is also the word to call out. Kara, to read and to call out are the same word in Hebrew. And one who reads in the Torah is called a kore, because he reads by calling out the words. Reading and speaking were together. If you couldn't speak, you couldn't read. Speaking and praying went together. If you can't speak, you can't really pray because you have to express the things with your mouth. And so being a mute was an awful thing, a terrible thing, because it prevented you from truly engaging God's word and truly engaging God. And not engaging his word and not engaging God leads to blindness. Blindness leads to sin and death, and your life just leaking out of you. You see how Yeshua is working backwards into the very heart of the issue? And here it's not a physical problem, it's a deep spiritual problem. There is no demon involved with the blindness of these men. There's no demonic involved with the woman with the hemorrhage, or even the girl that was dying. But for someone who cannot speak forth, who cannot speak to God, who cannot speak his word, cannot engage it, now that has a deep spiritual problem, a deep spiritual cause. And he's revealing that this is something that's from the enemy himself. So how did this man with a demon get healed? Did he come to Yeshua asking for deliverance? He couldn't talk. It says, then people brought to him a mute man. They brought him to Yeshua. Yeshua was brought to the dead girl. The blind men came to Yeshua, but he had to be brought. The mute man had to be brought to Yeshua himself. And I think if we know people who are afflicted by a deep spiritual issue, talking to them about it doesn't help much. Nothing else really helps but bringing them to Yeshua. However you do that, through prayer, through living a life, through somehow modeling Yeshua, and however it is, in some gentle way, ushering them into Yeshua's presence. How that is done with the person you may be concerned about and praying for, I don't know. But I think this is the key that you need to figure out. if you want to truly help this person. And then we finish the chapter. Yeshua circled through